This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Whether you're just looking to stay warm during a hunt or need maximum concealment, the clothing you wear can make or break a hunt. At MidwayUSA.com, we understand hunting clothing has come a long way with more meticulously crafted camo patterns, advanced scent control technologies, and weatherproof options to withstand the elements. Hunters have to wait until their favorite season, but shouldn't wait on gear, which is why MidwayUSA offers super fast shipping. When you're ready for your next system, log on to MidwayUSA.com.
Oh, here we go, boys.
Go.
Ooh, I love that sound. This is a good one.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Full Scale Outdoors Podcast Waterfowl Wednesday edition. I'm your host, Nick Johnson. We're doing a solo episode, and if you are unfamiliar with the way we do that, we are going to be going through some interesting and relevant waterfowl-related news stories that have been coming up on the internet. But first, today, I did want to start off by just doing a little bit of a little gear review. I just picked up a new piece of gear. I'm kind of excited to actually use this piece of gear because it's a piece of gear that's never been in my arsenal before. I gotta give a shout out to Mr. Cole Frost for putting this on my radar screen and convincing me it was worth the investment because it was quite spendy. And what I've purchased is a marsupial gear binoculars chest harness. So I think like binoculars are completely underutilized in the waterfowl hunting space, and it's not for a dumb reason. It kind of sucks hunting with binoculars for ducks and geese. Whether you're on a boat and you're in wet conditions with cattail seeds going everywhere and a dog shaking off every time it retrieves a bird, or you're in a layout blind, which is completely filled with dirt and dust and debris, it's just always a difficult thing to hunt with binoculars while you waterfowl hunt. And I try to bring binoculars on every hunt, but if there's not room in my backpack amongst all the food and water and gear and other crap that I pack, man, like I'll find myself leaving the binoculars out. And if the binoculars do come with me, they're basically completely useless unless I also remember to pack a microfiber towel so I can continually clean the binoculars while I hunt, because they're continually getting like super dirty and grimy. Another problem that comes up with this is because my binoculars are always in a state of getting dirty and just a state of peril, I've never owned like a nice pair of binoculars. Right now, I think I rock the base model Vortex, not the Diamondbacks, the $150 versions of them. But part of the reason why I've never actually upgraded to good optics is because it's tough to have good optics as a waterfowl hunter. So my buddy Cole Frost, he's been hunting a little bit with this marsupial gear pouch, which is just a chest pack for binoculars. Now, my Vortex is, I have the Crossfire HDs, 10x42s, super cheap pair of binoculars, I think $150, by the way. So that came with a chest pack, and I tried to use it, and I just found it to kind of be, like, not very functional. Like, as it's sitting on your chest, like, it pulls up from the bottom to open it. The marsupial gear pouch actually pulls down from the top. It's fully enclosed, so it should keep dirt and debris out of it. It's got a little tab. You can use it one-handed, so you just, like, pull it down from the front. It's got magnets that clip, and it's just got a nice, like, strap harness system to it. So I'm actually kind of pumped to, like, try out this binocular pouch. Like, A, is it going to be able to actually be, like, quote-unquote enclosed and keep my binoculars, like, clean all the time? And it's just, if I could just have a better way of using binoculars while I waterfowl hunt and don't have an excuse to not pack them on a hunt, that's something I'm super excited about. Because whether you are marking where birds, like crippled birds, is hitting like the tall grass, you know, like, all right, it's exactly by that little bit of a broken fence post, or it's exactly by this tree, or you're just keeping your eye on a bird that's walking away, whether that, or somebody's like, what is that? Is that a goose out there? Boom, binoculars. No, it's a crow. Shut up. What was I saying before? Just having binoculars on a waterfowl hunt is just always super, super awesome. So yeah, I'm excited to try this out. Obviously, this podcast has zero sponsors. So Marsupial is not a sponsor of this podcast. Just a piece of gear that a hunting buddy of mine kind of, I noticed they were using it, like, and I reach out, like, hey, what do you think of that? Is it working good? Does it get in the way of your calls? Like, no, it's straps on your body good. It seems functional to use. You should try it out. I look it up. It's $145 or $135. Like, God damn, for a fucking chest pack for binoculars? Like, am I really gonna spend that? Like, all right, well, I bit the bullet, I bought it, and I am kind of excited to try it out. Check them out if you also would like, if you'd also like to maybe use your binoculars more on waterfowl hunting. Hopefully this is like a piece of gear that actually makes that possible. Anyways, I just been kind of excited. That just came in the mail, and I've just been, like, wearing it around the house and be like, yeah, I think this is going to work. So I decided to just give them a quick little shout-out. Seems like a super, super sweet binocular pouch. So anyways, let's jump into a couple of, like, interesting articles that I have came across recently. There's some kind of big news that has been coming out of Montana recently in the waterfowl hunting space. Montana is obviously a mountainous state, not a whole ton of waterfowl hunting going on out there, but they do have a couple bright spots. One of those bright spots is along the Yellowstone River, where for like the last 60 years, it has been completely closed down to waterfowl hunting. So let's jump into one of the, I've actually got like tons of different articles about this. From what was happening is they were talking about opening up this stretch of Yellowstone River to allow waterfowl hunting. So here's an article from the Outdoor Life magazine. It says, a stretch of the Yellowstone River, long closed to waterfowl hunting, might reopen soon, and some hunters aren't thrilled. Next month, the rulemaking body for Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks will decide whether to pass the migratory bird regulations proposed for 24-25. This year's regs include a proposal to allow waterfowl hunting on an 87-mile stretch of the Yellowstone River in eastern Montana that's currently off-limits to waterfowl hunting. Even though most waterfowlers would welcome more public hunting access, some don't think it's a good idea to remove these protections. The stretch of river between the confluence with the Bighorn and the Rosebud Custer County line has been restricted, quote-unquote, since 1958, when Canada goose numbers were incredibly low and wildlife managers needed to take drastic action to protect what few birds remained. An FWP fact sheet published by the Billings Gazette in 2007 recalls a 1961 bird count that tallied 546 geese and 3,187 ducks in the highline population of northeast Montana. which is kind of crazy. So in 1961, there was 500 geese on that 87-mile-long stretch of Yellowstone River. Seems low. So obviously, they had that closed down for good reason. Now, the Highline, so it says, by 1970, the Highline population had jumped to 40,000. And by the mid-2000s, it was closer to 225,000. In the last decade, the population has grown by an average of 2% annually and now sits around 325,000 birds. So the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is basically saying, like, okay, yeah, we started out with, whatever, 600 geese, and so we closed this river down to waterfowl hunting. And now we've got over 300,000, so how about it's all right if we just open this river back up, because it doesn't really seem like there's a purpose to keep it closed. Now, something like this, all my news articles, a huge thing that I keep my eye out for is new opportunities for waterfowl hunting, like expanded hunting opportunities. Anything that pops across my desk like that just raises my attention right away. Like, if you can get in to hunt somewhere where previously you couldn't hunt, that is going to be something potentially very, 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 very good. However, typically I'm just an advocate for hunters, for waterfowl hunters. Like, I'm an advocate for more hunting opportunities and for better opportunities, more expansion of the opportunities for people to hunt. So naturally, this would be something where I'd be like, yeah, why is the Yellowstone River closed? However, I have been to this area and I have hunted it many times through the years, and I know that along the Yellowstone River in eastern Montana, there is a lot of Canada geese that will use that river as a resting area. And the reason that I am against opening up that stretch of river is because they have fantastic public goose hunting opportunities along it. So what they have in Montana is they have something called block management. Block management is a program in which landowners enroll their land in block management. There's a couple different forms of it. Some you can just go onto somebody's property just by signing in. They've got a mailbox that you stop at and you sign into block management. You put your slip in there and then you go into, and then you have access to the property. And there's only so many people who can access it per day, yada, yada, yada. These landowners, they take these slips that they get like in that mailbox and they will, they'll turn them in for cash. So Montana's not a huge waterfowl hunting state. It's more big on like upland bird hunting and upland birds and big game, obviously. Now, one thing I had heard, I guess I don't really know if this is true, but one thing I've heard is that people who have good waterfowl hunting land, say along the Yellowstone River, I mean, there's only so much agriculture. You got a little river, the Yellowstone. You got the Yellowstone River, and you've got valleys with agriculture. And the geese aren't going anywhere but those valleys with agriculture. They ain't flying over mountains to go feed 30 miles away. They're just kind of sitting along the river and jumping into the fields. So with this block management thing, a lot of guys will get, you know, a guy or two that'll go, they'll just enroll their land in block management. Say you got a whole bunch of upland land or a whole bunch of big game land. You get a guy or two that kind of comes in there. You turn in your slips, you kind of get a little bit of a kickback. The kickback is paid for by your hunting licenses. So one thing I had heard is that the people who have good waterfowl hunting property love block management, because you don't just get a guy or two that comes through, you know, hunting mule deer or whatever, elk or, you know, upland birds. You get like six dudes or eight dudes who sign into your property. You know, they're in a hunting party. And a lot of these fields, they're just traffic fields. So guys will get lots of hunting groups throughout the years, like more so than, let's say, somebody who enrolls in block management for upland or for big game. What I'm trying to get at is, like, there's kind of a bigger incentive for people to put their land in block management if they have good waterfowl hunting land. And that kind of makes sense to me, because in eastern Montana, along this 87-mile stretch of the Yellowstone River, there is just a ton of block management. There is a ton of public hunting. There is block management. There's even some like state land that's cornfields. Anyways, there's really, really good public hunting opportunities along the entire stretch in the form of block, state land. I think there's maybe some WMAs, and also there's even some Bureau of Land Management stuff. There's just kind of a plethora of different ways to access getting underneath these Canada geese. So I actually was very opposed to opening up this stretch of Yellowstone, because I figure, okay, well, what happens once that stretch gets opened up to waterfowl hunting? People are going to start hunting it. Where are they going to hunt it? Where they can access it? So from the access points, which obviously I don't have a boat, I don't really know exactly where all the access points are, but I can just imagine no matter where there's an access point, just going, branching off from that, you're going to start clearing waterfowl away from it. And you're going to push water. It's not going to completely remove birds off the Yellowstone River, but I do think it's going to push them into more isolated pockets along it. So whereas this stretch of river kind of holds birds from one end to the other, maybe the only limiting factor being like, where are the good sandbars from year to year and what part of it is completely iced over compared to what parts still kind of have open water, which has something to do with the water level year to year. Now we're also going to be just pushing birds off like from wherever the access points are and or wherever people can access the river from private property and even just hunt the shoreline or launch a small boat or a regular sized boat from that shoreline on private property. And then we're going to just start pushing geese and ducks to more and more isolated spots. I think it'll concentrate the birds into smaller areas. And that would kind of like just render a lot of the public hunting access like useless. Like if the birds aren't staging near the public access, it's not beneficial to exist really. Like, and in that area, like I said, it's not infinite fields everywhere. I mean, the birds are, it's valleys and a river, and the birds are just going from the river into the valleys and feeding there. So once you push them away from certain valleys, like you're eliminating huge amounts of hunting opportunity. So also they had done a survey, you know, like these surveys go out to all the resident hunters. Like we talk about surveys on this show quite a bit and how important it is to fill out surveys. Well, the surveys came back and like, shit, I did have that. I had it pulled up. It was on the Montana website. And I was actually looking at it today about how many, about the survey respondents and their feelings about opening up the Yellowstone River. And their feelings were, they were like, strongly agree with doing it or basically were neutral. It was like 70% of people were like agree or strongly agree. And it was only like 20% of people that thought it was a negative thing. Well, as soon as it started hitting the press and the outdoor life, the comments actually really started rolling in. I even was on the public comment sheet and I read my comments and saw that it got viewed. And then I actually was scrolling through. I just found myself kind of locked into a scroll, just reading people's comments on the proposal. There was like 320 or something like that. I saw a bunch of people's names on there that I recognize. Some other hunters, friends of mine. And I read their public comments. And everybody was really well-spoken and really polite. And there was landowners on there. And there was hotel owners on there, restaurant owners on there, people who have lived in the area. They're saying like, hey, let's not mess up this good thing. And they did end up not opening up that part of the Yellowstone. So here, this first article I read was from before the decision, and then this one is after the decision. Fish and Wildlife keeps part of Yellowstone River closed to bird hunting. A proposed plan to open up an 87-mile stretch of the Yellowstone River to bird hunting has been shot down yet again. I think it came up for a vote maybe 5-6 years ago. The same thing happened. Montana Fish and Wildlife and Parks had proposed opening that stretch of river frontage to waterfowl hunting, which would have upended a 66-year ban. Fish and Wildlife Commissioner Brian Siebel from Region 5 proposed keeping that portion closed, and the rest of the commission agreed. That Yellowstone River frontage starts at the confluence and extends to the Rosebud-Custer County line. During a Zoom meeting on Wednesday, Siebel and other commissioners cited the high number of public comments as the reason for keeping the river closed. So, just public comments really do make a huge difference in the way we want to be able to hunt waterfowl, and we can really influence the decisions being made for states, even an outer stater like me, who I'm like, hey, I've been out there. This was fantastic. I love the public hunting opportunities. I would hate to see less public hunting opportunities. You know, it's a balance. Would more people be able to hunt on the river? Sure, but would some of those block managements and other public lands be rendered useless? Possibly. So anyways, hunters and landowners say the river provides a refuge for geese flying south for the winter. They also say it would have been a challenge retrieving hunted birds on private land and on the river during times it is frozen. Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so cool story out of Montana. Raised a lot of eyebrows, got a lot of people's attention, and the people responded, and the elected officials or the powers that be responded to the people by keeping it closed, which I think is awesome. Let's move on from the Montana thing. Avian influenza is back in the news, which is wild. This thing just keeps on going and going. I've got an article from science.org that says bird flu discovered by U.S. dairy cows. Bird flu discovered in U.S. dairy cows is disturbing. Scientists who track the infection on cattle farm discusses implications of recently announced virus detections. The bird flu virus that has wreaked havoc around the world appears to have resurfaced in U.S. dairy cows. The first time this viral subtype has been documented in any cattle. Three U.S. states, Texas, Kansas, and New Mexico, on the 25th of March reported cows sickened with what scientists are presuming is the same H5N1 strain of influenza that has killed hundreds of millions of poultry and wild birds. The cattle infections are spoiling milk and causing limited disease in mostly older animals. Dead birds have also been found in some of the farms, which may explain the source of the virus. Public health officials have stressed that the risk to humans from the virus remains low. The so-called highly pathogenic avian influenza virus spreading in birds has already been documented to infect dozens of other mammalian species, but rarely spreads between them. Earlier this month, HPAI was found in a goat in Minnesota, the first case in U.S. livestock. So the first livestock case came out of Minnesota. That's great. Gregory Gray, an epidemiologist for the University of Texas Medical Branch, calls the new detections in cows across multiple states worrisome development because it may signal that this bird flu strain is spreading directly between cattle instead of via birds and has mutated in ways that could allow it to better infect people. But preliminary studies on the affected cows shows no signs that the virus has changed, the National Veterinary Services Laboratory said in a statement yesterday. There's also a interesting podcast. If this avian influenza, I guess it's kind of like old news in the waterfowl community, but it is kind of interesting to keep your ears to the street and just hear how this this bird flu just seems to be much, much, much more serious on a global scale and also across species than previous bird flus that have come out. There is a podcast that just came out this week from the New York Times. The New York Times, the daily podcast, has a podcast called The Evolving Danger of the New Bird Flu. It's 23 minutes long. I listened to it. It was pretty boring, but it was informative of the bird flu and about how it's like getting into livestock. They were saying like it seems to be spreading between cows, but also it doesn't seem to be that serious of a disease to cows. Like they get a little sick, but they shed it quick and you don't have to like burn them all like you do with chickens and turkeys and stuff. So that's a pretty good boring and dry episode if you want to learn more about the new developments of bird flu from the New York Times that is picked up on the article. Let's see what else I got. This article came across and it just kind of it's about the two-shot goose hunt. So, this was in the Goshen County News, and it is called, name of this article is the Two-Shot Goose Hunt Committee Prepares Nests for the Next Batch of Goslings. Okay, so I'm like, what the hell is the two-shot goose hunt? This is from Torrington, Wyoming, which is in eastern Wyoming. And members of the Goshen County Two-Shot Goose Hunt Committee spent the day on Saturday sprucing up new homes for the next generation of Canada geese. That's nice. For decades, the Goshen County Two-Shot, in partnership with the Wyoming Game and Fish Department, has helped maintain nesting structures for geese at the Springer Wildlife Habitat Management Area and the Table Mountain Wildlife Habitat Management Area. The project is scheduled for mid-March in order to have these artificial nests ready before geese begin mating. Artificial nests are constructed with recycled tires, wooden platforms, and metal pipes. The Tyrant platform, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so they're putting up goose nests, but I'd just never heard of the two-shot goose hunt, and I wanted to learn more about it, and there was some cool stuff in here. Okay. Started in 1987, the two-shot goose hunt initially began as an economic development project to showcase the hunting, landscape, and people of Goshen County. The two-shot goose hunt consists of a whole series of events that focus on a shooting event taking place the second Saturday each December. The hunt allows approximately 40 teams each year, a number that has grown from the original 20. Each team consists of two hunters, who are allowed two shots each to bag their geese. The team with the most geese wins the contest. In the case of a tie, the overall weight of the geese is used to determine the winner. The teams are guided by experienced local guides that take the teams to heated blinds that are provided by local landowners. The hunt is conducted according to the rules of the Wyoming Game and Fish Department. The funds raised from the two-shot goose hunt are used for various activities throughout Goshen County and the great state of Wyoming. Hunter safety education is a priority for Two Shot. Several surrounding counties have received funds from the event to support hunter safety courses for Wyoming youth. The Two Shot also sponsors three scholarships each year to Eastern Wyoming College in Torrington. Habitat projects have always been a priority for the committee. Participation in many projects over the years include construction of pits for the public on the Bump Sullivan Public Hunting Project, habitat improvements and aerators on the Table Mountain and Springer Wildlife Habitat Management Areas, cleanup of the Springer Bump Sullivan and Rawhide Units, and goose nesting improvements. The Two-Shot Goose Hunt is a nonprofit organization run by a volunteer board of directors and composed by hundreds of volunteers throughout Goshen County and other parts of Wyoming and western Nebraska. That just immediately, I have never heard of the two-shot goose hunt. Immediately I'm like, dude, who am I taking? Like, who would go out there and do that with me? Because that would be so much fun. Like, number one, how would you win it? Like, you and one other guy, you have four shotgun shells. Well, obviously we're landing giants and raking heads, because I think the limit's five in Wyoming. All right, well, I'm going to try to kill five geese with those two shots. You can believe that. And I'm not taking no small geese either. Those little tiny birds that come off the roost first thing in the morning, you got them 5-6 pound, like, subarctic nesting geese, they ain't getting clapped. We're waiting till about 11 a.m., and we're going to start decoying 2 and 3 packs of some big boys and start rolling heads, if you know what I'm saying. We're winning that contest. See, these are the things that just go through my head. Plus, there's probably, like, a bunch of cool people to meet. There's probably a bunch of old-timers that have been doing that for, like, 30 years or however long they started doing it. Like, that automatically just rings my bell of, like, dude, I'm going to get a hold of this committee. I want to send an email out, and I want to get into this two-shot goose hunt next year or the year after and take a cool hunting trip somewhere. That's, like, one of those things, like, you know you're going to have a place to go goose hunt. Maybe you don't get who knows how they even get the pits or draw the pits for people or the blinds that you're going to hunt. Just go out there with 25 DSD giants and have yourself a good time. Go to the bar afterwards. Clink glasses with people who have been doing it out there, the locals, for so long. Like, boom. I don't know. That article, just a simple article about this local community putting up some goose nesting platforms, just gave me a ton of, like, cool and fun, exciting ideas for a potential goose hunt or goose hunting trip with my buddies. Yeah, if that's something like that lights your fire too, and maybe you just learned about it on this podcast, hell yeah, let's go. I got another article too that kind of came up. We're getting pretty close to, I got two articles here. This is just for my data nerds out there. My data nerds who want to see some interesting data, state-by-state data that is released by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, go to Google and then go to Google and punch this into Google right now. Fast facts about migratory bird harvest. Bam, you punch that in. First thing that's going to come up is the National Migratory Bird Harvest Survey website on the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service webpage, and it's called Fast Facts About Migratory Bird Harvest. You are going to get some really interesting charts. Also, if you can, do this on a computer. It's a government website. It's pretty freaking lousy to navigate. But, like, I just clicked on, here, I can go to this website, punch in Minnesota, and I can see that the top harvest by species is Canada goose.
The next, mallard, wood duck, blue-winged teal, ring-necked duck, green-winged teal, gadwall. I can see the top counties by harvest. You can even see these in a couple of different ways. Okay, that's a cool data nerd website if you're into data like I am. And government websites that aren't so intuitive to find. Check that out. Next article, this came across, I think today, but it's from an old study. And it was published actually January 10th of this year by Ducks Unlimited. And the article is called Understanding Waterfowl Science and Duck Calling. What kind of duck call makes the most realistic sound to a hen mallard? Scientists conducted a study to find the answer. Female mallards produce a wide range of vocalizations, including decrescendo calls, feeding and flight assembly chuckles, and single and multiple quacks. While duck hunters use many of these vocalizations in their calling repertoires, the decrescendo may be the most widely imitated by waterfowlers, typically consisting of five or six notes. The decrescendo begins with one or two loud, forceful quacks, followed by a series of progressively shorter, softer quacks. Anyways, they've done a study. Study areas and method. The research was conducted through MSU, as the topic of a Master of Science project by co-author James Calicut during the winters of 2008 and 2009. Calicut and fellow students first recorded decrescendo calls made by wild female mallards to serve as reference vocalizations for comparisons to human-operated duck calls. Recordings were collected in marshes, forested wetlands, and flooded croplands on public lands and private hunting clubs in Tennessee and Mississippi to ensure representativeness of calls across different habitat types. The researchers recorded 628 decrescendos using a portable cassette recorder with a directional microphone, but only vocalizations that were free of other background sounds were selected, and blah, blah, blah. So they recorded a bunch of hen mallards, they then recorded a bunch of duck call types, and they compared them. And they used human callers, volunteers. Callers were solicited via newspaper, social media, bulletin board postings, and local waterfowl management areas. 38 duck callers who rated themselves as average to good in proficiency were selected to participate. Dude, why didn't they just post on competitive duck and goose callers Facebook page? Get Trevor Shanahan and Seth Fields up in there. Anyways, the analysis results. Well, I am kind of curious about the analysis. When the recording sessions were complete, the research used acoustic software to extract individual decrescendos of female mallards and human callers. Next, they employed sound analysis software to measure several acoustic properties of each note produced by human callers and female mallards included in the studies. Discriminant function analysis and multivariate statistical procedure was used to classify similarities and differences in the acoustic properties of these sounds produced by humans and ducks. Results and recommendations. The researchers measured differences between the sounds made by human callers and female mallards based on the acoustic properties of entropy, quote, or parentheses rasp, pitch, shrill or soft, pitch goodness, pure or flat, frequency modulation, variation in pitch, and average frequency of notes per second in the decrescendo. Based on acoustic analysis, the most natural sounding duck call was, drumroll please, a Rich and Tone Mondo small batch series. Obviously, I'm joking. The most natural sounding duck call was a Coca-Cola Wood double reed, followed in descending order by an Osage Orange double reed, Osage Orange single reed, Pecan double reed, Acrylic double reed, Bocote double reed, Red Oak double reed, Coca-Cola single reed, Red Oak single reed, and Walnut double reed. Obviously, a cut-down duck call is not going to be on this list because they sound terrible. I'm just kidding. I do have an axe to grind with cut-down duck calls. Not mostly because they don't sound like ducks, which they really don't, but mostly because I suck at blowing them, so I hate them. I'm a J-frame all-day type guy. But that's what you're going to get out of a Minnesota duck caller that's been doing competition duck calling for 20 years. You're going to get a guy who loves J-frames. Anyways, that's a pretty interesting article that, check it out on the Ducks Unlimited page. And also, if you wanted to read the study, where would you find that? The study provides a fundamental scientific information. What study? Because you should be able to find this on Google Scholar, I imagine. So if you were to put in some of this stuff into Google Scholar, like duck call, just into the search articles, or this guy's name also. What was his name? I said it earlier. And it was I can't find it anymore. If you can find that guy's name, look up the article on Ducks Unlimited, find the guy's name, put the guy's name into Google Scholar, and you should be able to pull up this exact article or scientific paper and get a lot more information about how the study was done and what duck calls seem to make the most realistic duck call sounds. You know, being realistic is great. It's great to have realism, but sometimes, you know, you just need to be a little bit outside of the realms of realism, which is, I think, what, you know, like, obviously, open water competition style duck calls provide. You're much louder than real, but, you know, I'd rather have the ducks hear me and actually react to my sound in a scenario where it's maybe windy or the ducks are far away in an open water scenario. And maybe there's a reason why you're going to be using a duck call that has way too much like bark or rasp in it, like a cut down. You're going to accentuate a way for the birds to actually hear you. And you want to maybe get outside the realm of realism. But it's still cool to know. It's still a cool article. It's still a cool scientific paper to write. Other than that, guys, this has been going on for 34 minutes. God damn it. Here's one more interesting article. This is on RFD-TV. Researchers, expanding migration of South American whistling ducks in Louisiana could threaten native species. If you don't know, this is going to be about black-bellied whistling ducks. And also, if you don't know, they banned 3,000 black-bellied whistling ducks in Louisiana every single year. However, by the time season usually starts down there, they have already migrated out. God, would I like to know where those black-bellied whistling ducks go every winter so I could go band hunt black bellies. How sick would it be to take, like, a Mexico or Costa Rica or some like crazy Central American duck hunting trip and just mop up like dozens of black belly bands. That'd be awesome. Anyways, let's talk about Louisiana and black bellies. Let's just do this article quick. The state of Louisiana is known as a major wintering location for North American waterfowl. However, a new visitor may pose a problem. LSU Ag Center reporter Craig Gautreau brings us more on the whistling duck. There are 8 species of whistling ducks in the world, all of which are native to areas in North America or South America. Researchers worry this northward expansion of the particular South American species migration area will create a competition for resources that could pose a threat to waterfowl native to the region. That is why they are studying the birds now to determine if any precautionary steps need to be taken. Son of a bitch. That's all I got. Oh man, it's just ads after that. They're talking about black bellies. Is there like a load more? There's a video. Okay, there's a video here. There's a video you can watch if you're interested in learning more about that. RFD-TV, researchers expanding migration of South American whistling ducks in Louisiana could threaten native species. This is something that I think you're going to continue to see year after year showing up on pile pics in your social media feeds is going to be people shooting black bellies. There's a big article in Delta Waterfowl recently about how this is the fastest expanding species of ducks in North America. Expanding meaning like expanding their range as far as population of them is concerned. Considering the bulk of the population is still in Central and South America, I don't think they have any frickin' idea on... I don't want to speak out of turn. I might be speaking out of turn. I don't imagine that they have a good grasp on how many black-bellied whistling ducks there was in 1975 compared to right now, like they would have on something like a mallard. You know what I'm saying? So this is something that's really interesting. It's part of a couple of species that we didn't used to have in this country, and now we do, like Egyptian geese. Arkansas is considering opening up a season on Egyptian geese. Other places like Florida, you can just straight up kill them with pellet guns, like my buddy Joe Heinz did. Anyways, hey guys, thank you very much for tuning into this week's episode of Waterfowl Wednesday. I really hope that you will consider booking a hunt with me. I am in northwestern Wisconsin, 45 minutes east of the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. I've got some really good prices on some Canada Goose Hunts here in Wisconsin. It's a reasonable license cost, and we do really good. We have a lot of fun, hunt over Dave Smith's, and you make every hunt count, 110% effort. If you're trying to get better at goose calling, check out the Goose Tech app in your Apple App Store or the Google Play Store. It's available for $20. That's a one-time fee. It will help you get better at goose calling. And also, check out the Nick Johnson Signature Series from Pacific Calls. And if you're just looking for any sorts of new duck calls, goose calls, turkey calls, check out Pacific Calls. Thank you guys very much for tuning in, and we will catch up with you another time.
In Wild Country, rules were not created by man. Don't miss Wild Country, Wednesdays from 7 to 11 p.m. Eastern. Presented by Primos. Speak the language. Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment. Brave anglers search for the one they call king, but who will take his throne? Tune in to Waypoint TV's Battle for Silver, Saturday, May 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. Eastern. Presented by Abyss Battery. Waypoint TV.